Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit again with Spencer Wells and discuss Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization, published in 2010. Our interview is a follow-up to our 2003 conversation with Spencer Wells about his book, The Journey of Man, A Genetic Odyssey, in which Wells traces our roots as small bands of hunter-gatherers when our ancestors walked out of Africa approximately 60,000 years ago and began populating the world. Pandora's Seed tells the stories of what we humans, with our hunter-gatherer biological construct, have created in the past 10,000 years. These multiple lifestyle changes have produced what we call civilization, with systems and mechanisms that will not allow us to continue the lifestyles that are emulated by many people worldwide and exploited by those of us who have access to them. In other words, we can't last much longer doing what we are doing without radically reducing the way we all live, if not outright killing our species. Spencer Wells is an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C., where he leads the Genographic Project, which is collecting and analyzing hundreds of thousands of DNA samples from people around the world in order to decipher how our ancestors populated the world. He is also a professor at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. In this interview with Spencer Wells, recorded on July 19, 2010, we began with him describing the changes necessary now for our species' survival.
We need to gather lessons from people who still live in this hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which is how we lived, as you say, for most of our evolutionary history. And so, basically, when we settled down and became farmers 10,000 years ago, we started to exploit the land. We started to take from it, rather than living within the constraints that were provided to us by nature. And that set in motion many events that I trace in the book. But ultimately, it creates a culture of accumulating excess, greed, for lack of a better term. And so the lesson that I say that we should take away from these few remaining groups of hunter-gatherers, which, again, is how we lived for most of our evolutionary history, is that we should learn to want less, to live within constraints, to realize that, you know, the era of peak oil, for instance, is past, and, you know, climate change is a reality, and it's in large part due to the way our society has developed. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of lessons to be learned from these people who are still living in the way that, you know, we were meant to live.
Well, in my experience, having lived in South America for several years in the 60s and returned just a few years ago, there's a desire to live among the consumptive a section of society, even in the hills and the mountains of Bolivia and Peru. How do we deal with that desire to have more? It's really a worldwide social issue.
It certainly is. And, you know, it makes total sense living in the society we live in to want to accumulate excess. And, you know, it's very difficult to get out of that mindset. It's the only mindset that we've learned, in essence. But I think, you know, we need to step back and we need to look at what the long-term costs are. And if you start looking at the, you know, the recent social evolution, the last couple of hundred years, the Industrial Revolution, and so on, and you ask, where did that come from ultimately? And so ultimately you trace back to the development of agriculture 10,000 years ago, which was, in effect, the very first Industrial Revolution, the industrialization of food.
Well, let's talk about what some of those long-term consequences are that you have observed in Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization.
So the idea is that when we settled down and started growing our own food, and it made total sense at the time, it was a solution to a problem that was facing humanity, a huge problem, which was brought about by climatic shifts at the end of the last ice age. And in essence, we had too many people living on the land to continue living as hunter-gatherers, so we had to develop a way of growing more food. And so agriculture was the ultimate result of that. And so, you know, once that was set in motion, though, there were massive changes in human health, and you can see it very early on. So the hunter-gatherers living in the Middle East, for instance, immediately prior to the development of agriculture, were actually taller, they lived longer, they seemed to be healthier based on skeletal measurements and so on. And so there was this immediate kind of backlash, physiological backlash, our bodies reacting to the new food sources, agriculture. And in large part, this is because we replaced a lot of the very diverse plant sources that we were using in our diet. 150 species were used by the hunter-gatherer ancestors in the Middle East, with very few carbohydrate-rich plant sources. And so, you know, you have an increase in calories, but it's not actually better for us. And so this plays out today in the obesity epidemic, for instance, that we're seeing.
Can we put that in a time frame, the end of the last ice age?
The last ice age began around 120,000 years ago. And so we had populated the world, the work that I talk about in Journey of Man, during an ice age. And so we started to leave Africa around 60,000 years ago. We're moving around through Asia into Europe, into the Americas. All of this has taken place during an ice age. The last ice age ended around 15,000 years ago. And so, you know, this is the field that we were playing on, if you will, as we populated the world.
Going back to prior to when we left Africa, about 60,000 years ago, you make a comment that about 70,000 years ago, our species were literally on the brink of extinction, and you conjecture that there may have been a total of about 2,000 human beings in the world at that time.
Yeah, that's what the genetic data tells us. We also see a decrease in the archaeological record of the human presence. So, there's very little archaeological material around that time. But looking at the level of genetic variation in our species, which is remarkably low compared to other species of large primates, you can account for it with basically a bottleneck, a reduction in population size, to as few as 2,000 people living in Africa. And so we were virtually, you know, on the edge of extinction, and we came back from that.
And we came back from that in an ability to be adaptive, to be creative, to survive under new and difficult circumstances. And I think it's that ability that you're focusing on or suggesting we as a species focus on to get past the next 50 or 100 years successfully.
Yeah, that's really what distinguishes us as a species. We are incredibly adaptive or adaptable culturally. And so, you know, as we were moving around the world, we weren't really, you know, to a large extent, adapting biologically to these new places. We weren't growing long fur in northern regions and so on. But we developed the cultural attributes to allow us to survive in all of these very diverse locations. And so that is basically what we do. We're culturally adaptable machines, for lack of a better term. And that's our huge advantage. That's what's allowed us to be so successful. Now, the reason I titled the book Pandora's Seed is, if you think about the Greek myth, Pandora opens up this box, all these plagues fly out for humanity and so on. But what she saves in the box is hope, and that hope is our ability to adapt.
So then, drawing on our past adaptations that you have addressed in Pandora's Seed, what are the ones that you would anticipate being the most successful to help us get over the greed that our species has worldwide, often based, from my perspective, on the psychologically determined propaganda by the corporations that would like us to buy things from them for their benefit, as opposed to our benefit and the need to save our species?
Well, I think it really comes down to something that sounds fairly simple, but is actually quite difficult to put into practice, recognizing the consequences of what we're doing. You know, so often we make decisions on the basis of what's going to happen tomorrow or next week or maybe a year down the line. But, you know, we need to be thinking in terms of, you know, dozens of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years even in the future. And what are the long-term consequences of decisions we make today? And so I think that's the change in mindset that really needs to occur.
Basically, education.
In effect, yeah, yeah. Different kind of education, though. So it's not just about education that teaches you a set of job skills that you can use today, But it's, you know, longer-term education, longer-term thinking about, you know, what are the ultimate effects of what I'm doing today?
Well, when you reflect on the fact that a very large percentage of the American people do not believe in evolution, how would you redirect education? And there's an assumption in there that evolution has significant validity.
Yeah, well, you know, evolution is just an example of, you know, thinking that perhaps runs counter to received religious wisdom. And, you know, people want religion. They want religious answers. Religion provides answers to questions that, you know, apart from science, people can't answer otherwise. And so, you know, there are these sets of received wisdom in various religions around the world, and people rely on that. And it becomes a crutch, if you will. And what I argue in the book is that, yes, it's important to have this kind of mythos, this set of received teachings about, you know, who we are, and it provides a cultural stability, in effect. But, you know, to really start to solve some of these problems, we need to move beyond that. We need to start questioning why are things happening in such and such a way.
Well, it's that process that I would like you to describe for us. But first, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Spencer Wells about his new book, Pandora's Seed, The Unforeseen Cost of Civilization. Spencer Wells also is the author of The Journey of Man, and he visited with us on Radio Curious in 2004. And I would encourage you to go to the Radio Curious website, www.radiocurious.org, and have a listen to that visit, because it puts much of what we're talking about now in perspective. I'm Barry Vogel, and this is Radio Curious. Spencer, it's that last question, the idea of how we can translate this in a meaningful and receptive way to people around the world to keep us alive for another 100 years, get over this hump.
I certainly don't pretend to have all the answers, but what I can do is raise awareness about the way that we've lived for hundreds of thousands of years, which, again, is living much more in harmony with the world around us. And that ultimate change, you know, that change in our approach to the way we live really happened around 10,000 years ago when we developed agriculture, and it became much more exploitative, our lifestyles. And so, you know, basically what I'm saying is we need to step back and ask, well, why are we living in this way? And what are the longer-term consequences? And how can we change that if we want to be around, as you say, in 100 years?
Well, your book asks those questions. And my question to you is, how can we change it? For instance, in the seat of government in Washington, D.C., where you live and work, what might be done on a practical level for the average person?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to think about it in terms of politics, because obviously politicians, you know, their lifespan is limited to 4 or perhaps 6 years if you're a senator. You're always thinking about that next election and the re-election campaign. And you're not necessarily going to make decisions that are going to play out over the, you know, lifespan of, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years, that sort of thing, way beyond the time you're going to be in office. And so, you know, it's very difficult to change this way of thinking. And, you know, I think it's a change that needs to happen culturally. You know, we need to be having this debate, this broader debate about what are the consequences of our actions. And it happens internationally. You think about the Kyoto Protocol and so on, dealing with climate change and people recognizing that there are real costs to the way we're living. But it's very difficult to actually implement at a governmental level.
Let's talk about some of the consequences which would be hopefully reversed by the Kyoto Protocol, and some of the issues that have brought us to where we are. I think that perhaps that might spark a creative thought among some of our listeners.
The lifestyles we live today, they're incredibly energy-rich lifestyles, primarily fueling transportation of goods and people. So you get in your car, your SUV, and you can drive down to the supermarket and buy stuff from all over the world. And that has come at a cost. And the cost is the expenditure of energy and the increase in greenhouse gases. And so it's something that's very positive in many ways. It's wonderful to have these choices and to have the incredible level of mobility we have today. But with that choice and with that ability to move around comes these longer-term consequences. And climate change is the most glaring example of that.
Let's go back, and I'll leave the distance going back to you, Spencer Wells, in how we evolved as a species up to about 10,000 years ago and the changes that allowed us to become the creative people that we are. Our ability to speak, for example, our ability to create art. You deal with that in terms of the Kunstlerhaus in Austria, where people with what we would call mental illness produce some pretty interesting artwork.
Yeah, well, these are artists who are part of the school, for lack of a better term, that's called outsider art. And so these are people who haven't been trained as artists. They're people who are compelled to create art. And the Haus der Künstler, the House of Artists, was set up by Leo Navratil, an Austrian psychologist, back in the 1960s. And it has people living there who are schizophrenic, manic depressive. They have some form of mental illness, which is keeping them in this hospital. It's attached to a state mental hospital. And Navratil thought that by studying these people and their kind of desire to create art, you could really gain an insight into the creative process itself. And the question is, why do humans create art? You know, we think about the cave art at Chauvet and Lascaux and all these, you know, great sites in Europe with drawings of animals and so on. Why did people start creating those images? And, you know, it's probably a byproduct of having this amazingly adaptable brain. I mean, we can imagine things that aren't there in the real world. You know, we don't have an animal sitting in front of us necessarily, but we can draw a picture of it. And, you know, it's that ability to imagine things that aren't there that allows us to be so adaptable, you know, to create things that aren't there in the world. You know, so you imagine something, then you figure out a way to make it happen. And, you know, that's our great ability, as I said before, as a species, is, you know, to create things that aren't there, to figure out solutions to problems.
And then going back, again, I would leave the time period to you, is where there was a mutation that occurred that allowed us to speak and control the tenor and volume and quality of our voice.
Well, there were probably several mutations, almost certainly several mutations that allowed that. But there was a key change in a gene known as FOXP2. And this is kind of, I call it in the book, the kind of referee or the coach of the genome. It's one of these proteins that controls how other genes are turned on and off. And so there were a series of changes in this gene leading into the line, you know, leading up to humans and hominids that we don't see in other species of apes. And so these changes are necessary for the production of language. If you have a mutation away from this kind of iconic form of the FOXP2 that we see in almost everybody alive today, there are rare instances of people who have mutations in that gene. They can't speak. They can't formulate sentences properly. And so this is necessary for speech, but it's not sufficient. There were probably many, many changes that led to the ability to speak.
So when we have the ability to speak, we can exchange ideas in writing or spoken form where we don't see the speaker. And from that, people develop certain hard and fast beliefs. You have a section on fundamentalism and express your concerns about the roadblocks that fundamentalism is creating to resolve the problems that are the focus of your book. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so in the chapter on fundamentalism, I talk about the idea that, you know, everybody needs this mythos to survive. We want answers to these questions that science or everyday experience can't give us the answers to. And so, you know, religion is something, whether your religion is the religion of science or whether it's received wisdom from your ancestors living thousands of years ago, we want answers to some of these basic questions. Why are we alive? Where are we going to go when we die? These sorts of things. And, you know, the problem with that, though, is that it provides too much certainty.
Fundamentalism does.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, you know, when you're absolutely certain that you're correct, then people who don't believe what you believe must be wrong in some way. And it gives you a license to basically exploit them, attack them, whatever it might be. And so religion, as you say, is a fundamental roadblock to this change in thinking because, you know, there is no certainty in the world. And that is what the scientific worldview basically says to us. You know, we have to test everything. We have to look at the evidence for and against and decide on the answer based on that. There is no a priori answer to everything.
So in our world, we have several blocks of fundamental theories and fundamental belief systems that are in increasing conflict, as exemplified by what happened on September 11th. how do you see the fundamentalist concepts and the desire for material wealth or the benefits that electronic goods, for example, bring us, like this radio program? How do you see those two meshing, going back to the underlying question at the end of your book, where will the new ideas come from?
Well, again, I think we need to look at the longer-term unintended consequences of our actions, whether it's fundamentalism or the exploitative lifestyles that we lead today. You know, yes, it may make sense in the here and now to do all of these things, to hop in that gas guzzler and drive down the highway and throw things out the window, whatever it might be. But what are the ultimate consequences of doing that? And that has to be the shift in our worldview.
Well, we know the ultimate consequences, among them the rising sea level.
Well, certainly some people would say that. Others would argue, no, it's not happening. And that has to be the shift. We need to convince more people that there are real consequences, I think.
But that's looking at the past and projecting it into the future beyond what we see in our average 80-year lifespan.
That has to be the shift. We need to stop thinking in terms of, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow and more about what's going to happen to my great-grandchildren.
So if fundamentalism says that won't happen, that evolution is bogus, how do we penetrate those concepts?
I think education is the only way to do it. Again, that is ultimately our strength as a species, our ability to learn new things. We need to have a reason to learn these things. You have to see the consequences before you're going to act. And I think if you educate people about the consequences, then they will make the right decisions.
Isn't that what some fundamental practitioners believe they are doing?
Again, you know, it's going back to the fundamentals. It's not really about learning new things. It's about retaining old ways of doing things.
The fundamentals that you refer to are about examining the old ways of doing things before we became agriculturalists.
Absolutely. But it's really looking at a lifestyle that was, you know, good enough to see our ancestors through millions of years of evolution and in a very sustainable way. And, you know, we've developed this modern lifestyle, which is wonderful in many ways, but it also has these huge consequences. And so that's the reason I say we should take a lesson from these people who survived for eons leading a particular lifestyle.
Spencer Wells, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like you to share with us in your vast field of study a eureka or aha moment.
Probably the most amazing thing, the thing that still really floors me, is how recently we left Africa. The idea that, you know, we're 99.9% identical at the genetic level. We, as we talked about earlier, were on the verge of extinction 70,000 years ago. And it's only in the last 60,000 years, 2,000 human generations roughly, that we have gone out and populated the world and generated all of the diversity we see around the world today, the different skin colors and hair types and eye colors and languages and so on. It's a very, very recent phenomenon. And so, you know, that's the thing that still just really floors me.
I wanted to ask you about that. We discussed it when we talked about the journey of man. And that is, as I understand from what you wrote and from other sources, people of the northern latitudes developed a lighter skin color because of vitamin D. They could absorb it more.
Yeah, so the idea is that we're a hairless species of primate evolving in the savannas of eastern Africa, in the tropics, lots of sunlight. We needed a natural sunscreen, living out in the savannas. And so the original human skin color would have been dark, would have been brown or black. But it turns out you have to allow some UV light through to the deeper layers of your skin to biosynthesize vitamin D, which we don't normally get in our diets unless you eat a lot of fish or the diets are supplemented. And so our ancestors had to produce that basically by allowing sunlight through. And so in the tropics, that's not a problem. But as we moved into northern latitudes, we had to lose some of that pigmentation to allow enough UV light through to synthesize vitamin D. So we became lighter skinned in the north.
So on the Euro-Asian continent, there's a difference in the shape of the eyes on the eastern side. And you have described that as a social predilection as opposed to a genetic evolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's certainly genetically controlled because these are, you know, differences that we see very clearly in different regions of the world. But, again, they're only skin deep. They've arisen relatively recently. And, you know, there are people who would argue that the epicanthic fold, as it's called, the typical East Asian eye structure, is an adaptation. And, you know, that may be a possibility, but we don't see any clear evidence of why it would be adaptive necessarily. Is it adaptive to, you know, increased sunlight or colder temperatures or something like that? We don't know. But I think a better answer probably is a force that we know has played a role in human evolution, which Darwin described, known as sexual selection. And basically that comes down to people choosing mates on the basis of what they find attractive. And that can vary according to where you are in the world. And it can have profound effects on the way people look. And so probably some of these trivial features, for lack of a better term, these surface features that distinguish different human groups, racial characteristics, if you're talking in 19th century anthropology terms, originated through sexual selection. People choosing what they find attractive in a particular region, and over time, that becomes a fixed characteristic in that population.
Which could range from personal whimsy to creative theories of where we came from.
That's right. That's right.
The next question is, what would you like to do with the rest of your one special life?
The burning question for me, and I think for a lot of physical anthropologists, is what were those changes that led to fully modern behavior around 70,000 years ago in the human lineage? We see a profound shift in the archaeological material around that time. Art makes its appearance. We became fully modern behaviorally roughly 70,000 years ago, 60 to 70,000. What were the genetic changes that led to that, and what was the selective force that molded that? Basically trying to figure out what it means to be human, in essence.
And that, I presume, is the next focus of your work.
It's certainly something that I hope to focus on over the coming years.
And finally, is there a book that you would recommend?
The Histories by Herodotus. Herodotus, the father of history, 5th century BC Greek historian, who basically wrote about the known world at that time. And a lot of it was conjecture and stories told from one person to another until they finally got to Herodotus. But it presents a view of the world that's very naive and refreshing in a way. The world was still new, and it remained to be discovered in large part at that time. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful read.
Well, Spencer Wells, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Great talking to you, Barry.
The book Spencer Wells recommends is The Histories by Herodotus, a 5th century B.C. Greek historian. This interview with Spencer Wells was recorded on July 19, 2010, by telephone from his office in Washington, D.C. It and our 2003 conversation about the journey of man may be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.